Hello, welcome. Welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join us for a visit with leaders in personal and cultural transformation. This is Renee Poindexter, sitting in for Pathways host Paul O'Brien. Today, I have a very special guest. His name is Mitch Horowitz, and he actually is a vice president and executive editor at Penguin Random House, where he publishes authors living and dead, including David Lynch and Manly P. Hall. As a writer and a publisher, his lifelong interest is in man's search for meaning. He's the Penn Award-winning author of the book Occult America and One Simple Idea. He has been published in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Salon, Time.com, and probably many others that soon to be listed here. So Mitch, welcome. I understand that you live in New York City and you've got two sons that you're raising with your wife and you're a busy guy. Thanks for making time for our show today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, well, your book, the key book that we're talking about today is The Miracle of a Definite Chief Aim. And it's inspiring and in a way it's you're bringing the teachings of Napoleon Hill. And I'm just wondering if you could help put into terms, today's terms, what does it mean, the miracle of a definite chief aim?
Well, the centerpiece of Napoleon Hill's teachings, and Hill was the author of the book Think and Grow Rich, The Law of Success, and others, the real foundational starting point for all of his teachings about success and achievement is that you must have one absolute definite aim to which you're dedicated in life. And a lot of people hear that and they nod their heads and say, yeah, you know, I get it. I have an aim. I understand what I'm all about. But it requires scrutiny because sometimes what we actually have are a wide variety of aims, some of which are actually in contradiction to one another. Or we might have a very vague, very general aim that really doesn't define any central goal or purpose or activity to which we've committed ourselves. Hill's point was something different, and that's the basis and the starting point for this book. Hill's insistence was that if you look into the lives of people you admire, whoever they are, whether they're diplomats or inventors or soldiers or entrepreneurs or artists, whoever your heroes may be, you will almost always find that the individual who you admire passionately dedicated him or herself to one central goal around which their entire existence was organized. This goal needs to be held with emotional intensity. It needs to even be obsessive. And we think of the term obsessive as being a negative today. We think of an obsession as something that needs to be diagnosed and resolved. But Hill believed, and I think he was correct, that one of the tough truths of life is that if you look into the careers and the experience of truly exceptional people, you will almost always find that they had one aim that was really the beating heart of their existence. And he puts the question back to you, and I put the question back to you as a reader, as a listener. Have you found that aim in your life? Have you looked for it? Have you searched for it in a mature, sustained, really scrutinizing way? Think twice about whether you've really found that aim in your life. Because again, we have a tendency to sort of tell ourselves things. You know, these are my likes, these are my dislikes, this is what I'm trying to accomplish. But we rarely sit down and scrutinize ourselves in a mature and sustained way and say, what am I really willing, if anything, to dedicate myself to? Because that question and the honest answer that comes out of it unlocks and opens the door to capacities that would otherwise be undiscovered, untapped, and unused. It's only when we are really oriented toward a single aim that we discover what we're made of, so to speak. And so that's the goal of the book, The Miracle of a Definite Chief Aim. It's to come to terms with whether I have an aim in my life and then what is required to really act on that aim. I don't want anybody to ever reach a point in life where they say, I didn't try. You know, I didn't give it everything. And this book is intended to avert that.
Well, I think it's powerful how, you know, this is not just a philosophy for you. It's something that you discovered in your own life. Could you tell us a little bit about your story of what you thought was your aim, and then you fine-tuned it, and then it evolved into where you are today? Could you give us that story?
Sure, I'd be happy to. You know, these are things that I cover in the book, and I try to be very personal and very blunt about these things in my own life, because I'm asking people to kind of open themselves up to a program, open themselves up to a form of searching and self-scrutiny, and I can't really place that demand on people unless I'm willing to be frank with them. When I was a kid, I was actually interested in theater. I was interested in drama, in acting. But my household was torn apart by divorce and financial disaster, and this is the case of course, many households in America and elsewhere. And feeling that I was being very practical and being very realistic as a 16-year-old, I left behind drama and acting classes and decided I was going to strike out in more practical directions. Anyway, I was always enterprising. I was always motivated. And after college, I worked for a while as a newspaper reporter. That wasn't really for me. And I went into publishing, feeling that my interest in arts and letters could be cultivated in publishing while also securing a paycheck and health benefits and the other things that are necessary in life. And strangely enough, I reached a point in my mid-30s. Today I'm 51. I was in my mid-30s. I'd worked in publishing for several years, and it had been good to me, but I felt absolutely directionless. I felt that I stood for absolutely nothing. And I had left behind an identity of myself as an artist. I had left behind an identity of myself as a writer. And I just felt that that was one of life's breaks that had to be dealt with, that had to be digested, that had to be accepted. As it happened, through a series of relationships and in ways that I wouldn't necessarily have expected, I re-entered writing when I was in my late 30s. Some friends of mine at Science of Mind magazine, which is one of the positive thinking monthlies, probably one of the oldest of that genre in the country, asked me to do an interview with the Major League Baseball pitcher Barry Zito. Barry used New Thought and Creative Mind metaphysical methods as part of his training regimen, and they had landed an interview with him, planned to put it on the cover, and wanted to make sure that it went well. So they felt they could trust me to talk to Barry and produce a really sturdy article from the experience. And this was in the late summer of 2003. And I spoke to Barry and I made the determination that I was going to write this article with real excellence. I wanted it to be much more than just kind of a passive interview where I repeated back whatever he told me and tried to find some loose theme, but I wanted to make it something that was a real study of how a master athlete could apply creative mind principles, positive mind metaphysics to his training regimen. I'm very interested in athletics and mental therapeutics, because not only do mind power methods figure very prominently into athletics, but athletics give you a way of measuring success that's very concrete. Athletes are required to have certain goals, whether it's a distance leaped or time made running around a track or pitching speed or whatever. You're not going to win every game, but you do have certain goals for personal performance. And so in that sense, I find athletics a really interesting field to scrutinize in terms of the metaphysical experience of the athlete, him or herself. So I spoke to Barry, wrote the article, which is called Barry's Way, can still be found online. And it was just an amazing experience for me because I felt like I had rediscovered myself as a writer. I left behind journalism, not knowing what I really wanted to focus on, not being satisfied with the field, having my own ups and downs within it. But suddenly, when I was writing about metaphysical experience along the lines that I was just describing, I felt a certain sense of purpose and aliveness and an energized mission. Suddenly I knew why I wanted to be a writer, and I knew what I wanted to write about. I knew that I wanted to document metaphysical experience in history, in the lives of other people, in my own experience, and in ways that it could be applied. I wanted to become a kind of great documenter and communicator and historian and philosopher of metaphysical experience in a way that really brought it down to the day-to-day needs of the individual, which is what I try to do in this new book. And I had my definite aim. I had my definite aim. I knew that I wanted to document metaphysical experience in history, in the lives of others, and in ways that it could be used and applied. And I was off and running. And within 2 years, I had my first book contract at Random House. I wrote my first book, which was called Occult America, which is a history of supernatural religion in America. My next book was called One Simple Idea, which was about how the positive thinking movement had shaped and impacted modern life and what lasting lessons of real posterity we could draw from the positive thinking movement, and so on and so forth. And my writing today on alternative spirituality has appeared in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Time, CNN.com, and so on and so forth.
That's powerful.
And so, you know, I was in a situation where I was in my late 30s, and I really felt convinced that I had left writing behind, that I didn't think of myself as an artist. I thought of myself as a publisher, which is a noble profession, but it was almost a runner-up, you know, at best. And I found the experience as I was entering middle age, and as I mentioned, today I'm 51, to be able to rediscover myself as an artist. And that was, for me, an incredible experience. And it came after years in which a desire in me had been dormant. But once that desire, in this case, the desire to write, was reawakened, and I really discovered a very specific, very focused area that I could dedicate myself to, in this case, metaphysical experience, metaphysical history, all my energies were summoned, and I found myself drawn into it with this complete and total passion. And it's taken me in many, many different directions, in books, in narration, in media appearances, and so forth. And I can tell you, you know, I didn't publish my first books until I was well past the age of 40, well past the age of 40, at a time when people think, well, gee, you know, it's time to be settling down. It's time to come to terms with reality and with what is being offered to me. So I write about that in this new book. You know, I try to be very, very blunt and direct with people about my own successes and failures, about where I've hit walls, where I've found my way over walls, what walls I still face, you know, because I do believe very deeply that there needs to be verity, there needs to be truth-telling in metaphysical literature. And I feel very strongly about that. And I feel very strongly that a person who's writing in the genre of applied metaphysics or self-help or what have you, they owe it to the reader to be blunt with that person, not to put on some sort of a dog and pony show where they're, you know, kind of holding up their own life or the lives of other people as an example of satisfaction or, you know, perfection. Believe me, I've worked with many of these people. I'm still in publishing. I've been in publishing for many, many years, and I've seen many of your favorite self-help writers up front and personal, and they are just as desperate and broken and in a state of difficulty as the rest of us, you know. And so I don't go for any airs or any phoniness, you know. I, if I'm not being honest with my reader about my own life and experiences and about my own application of these ideas, then I've failed. I think we really need great verity and forthrightness.
Exactly.
In these books.
Exactly. You know? Because, you know, people that are in that evolution of consciousness where they gravitate already at that resonating frequency that you speak of, you know, those are the people that are already thinking that way. But the ones who are struggling for a new way of thinking, you have to take your esoteric ideas. And I think the Washington Post says that Mitch treats esoteric ideas and movements with an even-handed intellectual studiousness that is too often lost in today's raised voice discussions. And we've got a lot of raised voices going on in our society today, don't we?
For real, yes.
Absolutely. And what I love about this book is, yes, you're taking not only this book, but other books that, you know, Napoleon Hill, but you refer to James Allen, you know, the life of James Allen, and connecting with people who are dealing with economic challenges and pitfalls, and how his story could be transformational for people going through struggles today. You know, could you share a little bit about that? Because I think a lot of people go, yeah, that's good for you, Mitch. You found your way and you've got your, you know, your livelihood and you figured it out, but I can't get there, you know?
Yeah. And I sympathize with that, you know, and I try to address that very plainly in the book. You know, there are times, for example, where we all want our idealized work to pay the rent, so to speak. And that's the goal and that's the aim. And it's the aim I have too. It's not always possible. But there are times it is. And there are certain steps that a person can take to figure out and to really come to terms with whether it's possible, rather than looking at it as just a great what if. A case in point for me, as you alluded, is the writer James Allen, who was a British writer who lived in the early 20th century and wrote a very famous book called As a Man Thinketh. Now, he really did come from a situation of brutal poverty. His father died while he was looking for work here in America. He was murdered, in fact, in a murder robbery, and James and his mother and two brothers were left destitute. He had to leave school at the age of 15 and work in a factory job in central England in the textile trade. And he spent almost 10 years in that work, but he maintained an extraordinary level of self-education, and he was very, very interested in the new metaphysics, mental healing, Christian Science, New Thought, all the various things that might be loosely grouped under the positive thinking culture. And eventually he started writing in this direction. And again, you know, James's possibilities as a writer, as a scholar, as a philosophy seemed to be dead when he had to leave school at 15 to go work in a factory to support his family. But there, he knew what he wanted out of life. He was fascinated with the world's religions. He had a determination to locate a common thread in the world's religions, which he instinctively believed was there. And the thread that he felt he had discovered was the principle that our thoughts, to a very, very significant extent, determine our character, and our character, our experience. So that what we think helps organize and prioritize and even in some cases materialize our relationships, our opportunities, our work circumstances. And James felt that you could find that principle in virtually every religion, that we were given this almost uncanny ability to shape our character through our thoughts, and through our character, some aspect of our destiny, some aspect of our destiny. And so he located that principle in the different historic faiths, and he wrote about what he located in many books, but far and away his most famous book is from 1903, As a Man Thinketh, which is probably one of the most widely read inspirational books of all time, still very widely read today. Many people swear by it. People carry it with them. To some people, it has almost scriptural significance. So I use James's life as a kind of case in point for what can be accomplished when a person has come to terms with what they really, truly want. And that is something, and I believe this with all my heart, you know, we're going to face circumstances that we can't control. We live under many, many laws and forces. I've never subscribed to the dictum, there are no accidents. I think, in fact, there are accidents in life. Sometimes they're happy and sometimes they're unhappy. We cannot control the complexity of all things that come at us in this world. But one thing that we can control, that we do have within our control, is the ability to sit down in a mature, sustained way and come to a really sincere sense of our central purpose in life, what we want to accomplish, what we're here for, what we're dedicated to. Do that, because if one doesn't do that, you won't know whether it's possible. It's easy to speculate, but you won't know. And James Allen did that, and it opened doors to him that would otherwise have not been there.
Exactly. Well, your book is really takes these philosophies and with real stories of real transformations of people, and then you give some really cool techniques and examples. And I wish this show would last for 2 hours, but I was wondering if, I'm looking at the three-step miracle or affirmations or the I can do it moment. I mean, which one, technique would you want people to take away from this conversation as they go to the bookstore to buy your book?
Well, it's interesting. There are many techniques that I talk about in the book, and they're all simple if a person is willing to apply him or herself to them. One technique that I talk about, it's so simple, it's easy to forget and it's easy to brush off. And that is stop gossiping, stop engaging in gossip, rumor, talebearing. Cut it out of your entertainment, cut it out of your personal conversations. It takes up an enormous degree of energy. It puts us in the company of terrible people. It evokes the worst traits in us. It harms the reputations of other people. It depletes our own energies. And in ways that we don't see but that are subtly present, it enacts in our own lives some of the very same things that we would decry in others. A concrete improvement that everyone on this call can enact in their lives literally immediately. Literally, when you stop listening to this exchange, is to abstain from gossip, from talebearing, from things that involve the humiliation of other people, that violate the privacy of other people. Don't do it with your work colleagues. Don't do it with your friends. Don't do it with your coworkers. Don't do it online. You will experience a rise of energy and a level of sobriety and capability that you never knew was there. Your productivity will improve. Your creativity will improve. Your sense of personal nobility and self-regard and self-possession will improve. You will get more things done. So that is one very, very simple step that's good for other people and it's good for you. It will make you into more of a leader. It will make you into more of a noble person. So I like all the steps that you cited as potential examples, and
Yeah,
I'd
exactly.
be happy to go into all of them. But that was one that I was just thinking about this morning that anybody can enact, whether you read it in the book or not. You're hearing it right now, and
Exactly,
you'll be
exactly.
amazed at the improvements that you experience in life and the improvements that you bring to others.
Exactly. Well, that's very powerful. And, I also told you that I took the 30-day challenge, the 30-day mental challenge,
Yes.
and I've taken it to clients and companies and individuals I'm working with. And could you, in two sentences, explain what that is, the 30-day
Oh,
mental
sure.
challenge?
It was, I was reading an early 20th century book of mind power philosophy, and there was an unnamed scientist in this book who had reached his 50th birthday and was in absolute despair. And he decided that he was going to experiment with some of the new metaphysics that were popularized in America in the early 20th century. And he set himself to a program of thinking only along affirmative, constructive, productive lines for a period of 30 days just to see what would happen. And he found that his life dramatically, dramatically changed. So I took this exercise and morphed it into something I call the 30-day mental challenge. And it's as simple as it sounds. And if anybody contacts me, I will send them over email a short column that I wrote about the 30-day mental challenge. It basically has to do with making a written vow to yourself and doing everything you can over the course of 30 days to keep this vow, to focus your mind strictly on that which is advancing, productive, constructive. Like me, you will fail at it sometimes. You will, find within 5 minutes, you violated your vow. It doesn't matter. Just,
Yeah, exactly.
get back on the bicycle and keep
Exactly.
pedaling, keep
It's,
trying, and
yeah.
see what happens. The point is not for me to tell you what happens. The point is for you to see what happens. So I invite everybody to attempt that exercise. It's very simple, but it does require a great deal of dedication.
Exactly. Well, I'm in it for 30 days, so I've got several people with me. So I encourage people, you know, Mitch, I wish we had much longer to talk with you on this show, but we've about run out of time. So where can people reach you for more information?
If you throw my name into Google, Mitch Horowitz, it'll take you directly to my website, MitchHorowitz.com. That links to lots of articles, videos, writings. My email is also on there. Anybody who wants to email me is welcome to, and I will send them a copy of the 30-Day Mental Challenge.
Exactly. And you've got some other books in the works, I know. Because
yes,
you're...
I have a new book coming out next year in fall of 2018 called The Miracle Club, which is my summation of what really works and why in positive mind metaphysics.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much. I would like to,
thank you.
Yeah, for those who have turned in late, this is Renee Poindexter sitting in for Paul O'Brien. And today we've been talking with Mitch Horowitz. And his most recent book, The Miracle of a Definite Chief Aim. This is broadcast and streamed via KBOO FM on Sunday mornings at 8:30 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Tell all your friends about Pathways and its podcasts. This is the interview program dedicated to personal and cultural transformation. Thanks for tuning in and for being a part of it.